Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I read a book, I do the review and stick it up online. Except tonight's episode is a little bit different because what I did, I'm recording this introduction after the fact, after the review itself. And what I did is I decided to do a live video stream of me recording the podcast. The thing is, as I was doing this, I did have internet connection troubles. So what happened then was that I kept on stopping and restarting and stopping and restarting. So the idea is that you could actually then go to ustream.tv/channel/Luke Burridge, and there you could just click once and watch the entire video as I did it and as I recorded it. This is you people now listening to this podcast. You could just stop listening to this podcast and then go and look at the video. But because of all the different disconnection problems that I had, the video is actually broken up into what, like 8 different parts. So I'm talking and talking and talking and talking, and then suddenly cut, and then it stops unexpectedly, and then you've got to press play on the next video, and I sort of repeat myself a bit. Of course, the people listening to this podcast now, this audio podcast, it's all going to be edited really, really smoothly. Nobody'll know anything that happened at all. So that's it. So for now, I'm just going to say, if you want to see the video, go to that Ustream TV link that'll be provided in the show notes, and you can see this whole thing and the questions and stuff and me responding to the chat room playing alongside. It was definitely a success. Probably do it again in the future at some point. But again, it's that weird thing that I don't have any set schedule. So if you want to see me do one of these video recordings again, I'll probably do one next week, probably Thursday next week. Actually, probably Wednesday next week if I've read the book that I'm going to review then. So yeah, follow me on Twitter, which is Luke Burridge, or at Luke Burridge, or whatever it is, or follow my blog, or keep up to date on the sfbrp.com wiki, and keep in touch, and we'll do it again sometime. So hope you enjoy this review, and hopefully that the video recording didn't get too much in the way of the audio recording that you're about to listen to now on the podcast feed. So see you at the other end. So yeah, let's get straight onto it. The book that I'm reviewing tonight is the first in the Hyperion Cantor series by Dan Simmons, and it is called Hyperion. And here I am showing it to the people with the live video stream. There you go. And it says on the front here, the Hugo Award-winning novel, which means it's meant to be pretty good. And I actually did really enjoy this. It's actually quite a record of novels that have won the Hugo Award, which I've read on the podcast, and I've just been a bit, mainly recently, I don't know. But I guess that's more of a self-selection process, because the older books that won Hugo Awards, they're still around and you can still get hold of them, and they're like classics like Dune and Ender's Game and stuff like that. But then I guess through into like the more recent history of the Hugo Awards, I guess, well, I don't know, maybe I just don't, you don't have that time selection going on at the same time. So anyway, enough about the Hugo Awards there. Let's get on to Hyperion. It's actually, yes, somebody in the chat room just shouted out hominids, which is, yes, exactly, to do with the Hugo Awards. Anyway, yes, Hyperion, let's get on to this. It was written in 1989, yes, 1989, and it's around about 500 pages long. Let me just flick to the end of the book here. Of course, the people watching live are seeing a book being held in front of my face here. So yeah, it's around about, what, 475 pages long. And first of all, let's just get straight into the universe of the book, the world of the book itself. And it's set in the distant future, well, not too distant, maybe around about, what, 800 years in the future? I'm not entirely sure. And the humans have spread to the stars. Now, when humans spread to the stars, normally they leave an Earth behind, or in the case of maybe the Foundation series, the Earth is destroyed in some kind of weird way. And that is actually what happens, or has happened already in Hyperion. Nobody is back on Earth because Earth doesn't exist anymore. It's been destroyed in a way, which I'm not going to spoil. You can read about it there in the book. So, of course, Earth's been destroyed. Everyone has to get off of Earth, and they're spread around many different planets, around about 1,000 planets, I'd say. And all of them have got different names, and they're all sort of like in this one bigger group called the Hegemony of worlds, or the Brotherhood of Man, or something like that. I can't actually remember exactly what it's called, but there is this big one single big monolithic political system that's keeping everyone in track. And of course, nobody's left on Earth. Some people on Mars, but generally people are spread around. Now, of course, helping to run things is some large artificial intelligence kind of setup there. You've got all these different artificial intelligence who have sort of, they've grown, outgrown the men's needs in many ways, so they don't actually need anything from humans anymore. But, you know, out of maybe the kindness of their heart, you know, maybe just because of that, they want to help out. So they do help out, they help run things. And the AI, the group of AIs is called the Technocore, and at the same time, you've got this continuous, all the time voting kind of thing going on called the All Thing. Oh, that's as far as I understand it. So it reminded me very much of the in the Joan DiVinci book, Heaven's Belt, or Outcast of Heaven's Belt, where you've got this continuous democracy kind of thing going on, where everyone is voting on things all the time. Well, maybe not all the time, but, you know, any kind of issue that comes up, everyone gets a vote, and you can do that with the technology there. It's really handy. And on top of all of this, you've got this faction called the Force. Now, the Force, whenever you read about the Force, it's always written in capital letters and with a colon and something else after it. So it's called something like Force Space or Force Infantry or Force something else. And I actually quite like having that little thing there, having Force in capital letters. It makes it, you know, it makes it sound almost more important and more militaristic, which is pretty cool. I quite like that. And so that's the kind of political setup. There is something else going on at the same time. The technology, I made a note here, starships get around with Hawking drives, a bit of a name drop there, one of many throughout the book, of course, and the Hawking drives, they get around, and there's lots of different styles of spaceship. You find out a few of them in the book. And then on top of that, the most important bit of communications technology, well, you've got the fat pipes. I think they're called fat pipes, and the fat pipes are They're just sort of like a fast-than-light communications device, but only information. And then you've got the Farcasters. And the Farcasters, it's very much like a standard teleportation device kind of thing going on. And when you've got that kind of thing, it's like you don't need, of course, all of the starships. Because when you've got the Farcaster, you can go from world to world easily, you know, as long as you can pay for the teleportation. And what actually happens is you've got lots of people have different homes, different rooms of their same home on different planets. And it's really quite an interesting section of the book where they talk about the different ways you can design a home, where you sort of step through your front door and you're on one planet, and you walk through you walk somewhere else and into the living room, and you want to entertain your guests. You entertain your guests in a place with a fantastic view, and then you go into the bath, and you sit in the bath, and you look up, and you're looking out into space because your bathroom is in a zero gravity space kind of thing. And that kind of thing is really quite interesting too. But generally, I must admit, a lot of the science fiction like elements, like a lot of the political ideas and the artificial intelligence ideas and the technology, is very, very standard for science fiction. I don't think there's a whole lot groundbreaking going on in Hyperion in terms of technology. Maybe there is, I'm not sure. I can't really think of what was standard at the time of 1989 when it was written. And I'm just thinking, you know, I was actually thinking just a few minutes ago, does it mean they're cliches? Are they science fiction cliches? Or are they tried and tested science fiction ideas that is taken from other people? I'm not entirely sure. I don't think they're cliches. I just think the style of the book, it's got so many references to literature and different styles of literature, which, of course, I'll talk about a bit more in a minute. But it's got so many of these different styles that maybe that sort of referencing to the standard science fiction cliches or, you know, tropes is just part of the style of the book. I don't know. So anyway, that's all about. Oh yeah, I made a note here. Things outside of the control of the Brotherhood of Man, or whatever it's called, hegemony. You've got the Ousters, which are sort of like the outside. Human faction, and they all live in zero gravity, and they've modified their bodies in different way, which is pretty cool. And they're like the bogeyman outside. And there's some other planets outside of the immediate control of the hegemony as well. And they are always sort of like brought into the hegemony, which I guess is what gives the hegemon its name. Should really learn how to pronounce all these words or get them clear in my head before I start the podcast recording. Anyway, so there are the other planets on the periphery, and one is of course Hyperion, named after a poem by Keats. Of course, I'll probably talk about that a bit more in the review as well. And on the planet of Hyperion, you get this little guy here. I'll just show the guys in the video here. You get this guy, and he is a shrike. Now, a shrike is an alien kind of thing, and he's set up, and he lives in these tombs called the Time Tombs. And the Time Tombs are this very mysterious kind of setup. And of course, I don't really want to spoil it too much, but I've got to talk about it a little way. What happens is that people go on pilgrimages to see the Shrike, and the Shrike has got its own cult, the Cult of the Shrike. I think it's probably called the Cult of the Shrike. And the way that works is that you go along there, and pilgrims who have nothing, they've got nothing left to lose, they go along and talk to the Shrike, and the Shrike is so powerful, he will grant requests to people. But then again, he might not. So if a group goes along there, he'll grant one request, and the rest of the people probably won't be that lucky. And yes, he lives in a place called, or near a place called, the Time Tombs, which is this weird thing with this like anti-entropy field around it. So time screws up in that different in that area, and the Shrike himself can actually control. He can control time as well. So that's the pretty much the world set up there. A few more people have come into the chat room, as I see here. Welcome along. So getting on to the story. Actually, when I first started reading this, I read the prologue, which is, you know, the first, 15 pages or so, like that. And then I started onto the next section, into chapter one, and it never really caught me. It didn't, like, grab me immediately, which is a bit of a pity, because I had other books to read, and I was going through a phase of testing out the e-book reader on the old iPod Touch here. And so as I started reading this, I got a bit distracted by The Time Machine, and then by other books that I wanted to read, and lots of other texts which I could read easily on the old iPod. And so I sort of put down Hyperion, and then tried and picked it up again, and then, because I couldn't remember what the prologue was, and so I put that down again. So it actually took me a good few weeks. But then I started reading it again, and I started right from the beginning on the prologue, and I read it all the way through. And actually, all I need to do is get into the first chapter, and then get into what the first sort of like sub-story within it, which is called The Priest's Tale. So the story is, what you have is that lots of stuff is going down on Hyperion. The ousters are, you know, maneuvering in space around the outside of Hyperion, and the Shrike is playing up, and lots of weird stuff is going there on Hyperion. But what happens is that the cult of the Shrike says, hey, normally we say people can make pilgrimages to see the Shrike, and they're picked randomly, but this time round, we've actually requesting a certain number of people to come and see the Shrike, you know, and this set of seven people, very important people, who all have like past history in some way with the Shrike, have been granted a way to, you know, they've been granted passage to see the Shrike, except they're not allowed to fly straight there. They have to land on the planet of Hyperion in the capital, and then make their way overland as a group to see the Shrike. And that's pretty much, you see, the whole book here is pretty much taken up with that story. Although it's a frame story, so along the way, all of the different characters, all the seven main characters at the start of the book, they all agree that, hey, we don't really know why we as a group have been called together here to talk to the Shrike. And it's a little bit vague at the beginning, sort of like what connects them all together. So what they say is, hey, what we should all do? So we should all tell each other our stories. And as we tell each other our stories, that way we'll be able to work out why we've all been put together. Now, this is a really nice device, nice frame story thing going on there. And I really quite liked it up until the end of the last story, or like the last section of the last story, which I'll talk about in a minute. So what I'm going to do is go through and introduce the different characters and talk a little bit about their tales. And of course, I'm not going to be spoiling anything here of the overall plot. I'll do as much as I can not to spoil the overall plot. Very important to say, every story is very different, because they don't just follow different characters, but they all go in different locations. Some of them take place on Hyperion, but other ones take, you know, a lot of them take place on different planets and or across different vistas than Hyperion. They've all got different themes And also, quite interestingly, they've all got very distinct writing styles and different things that they reference, which, of course, I'll talk about as I go through. So, yeah, first of all, you got the priest. And the priest actually starts his story by getting out a diary of another priest and starts reading from it. So we've got the overall frame story, and then we've got another frame story on top of that. So we've got two levels of frame story there, which is quite interesting. And yeah, so the priest tells a story of this other priest coming down, and it's told in diary form, so it's sort of like first person, but sort of being told in like almost a continuous, not continuous present tense, but like lots of chunks of past tense, sort of continuous updates in past tense. And so what happens is that this other priest comes into Hyperion trying to track down some people to minister to them, and he's got a bit of a history. Again, there's not really any point going into this story in any depth, but the point is that this other priest somehow, you know, meets the Shrike in some way, but it's a real horror story, and we get introduced to the Shrike as this real kind of mysterious kind of thing going on there, and he's not just got the Shrike cult, there's other things going on there, and we get introduced to all the tunnels. There's this massive network of tunnels underneath Hyperion, which of course I'm thinking the Shrike can go through and find different things underneath there and get around in underneath Hyperion. But it's a real, I actually really, really enjoyed this, and this is what really made me get into the book this sort of like third time that I tried picking it up and reading it, because this really had me gripped. It's really, really creepy. And because he's a priest, there's a lot of lots and lots of playfulness with different like religious iconography here, you know, because it's sort of like the people of the crucifix, and he's wondering, okay, what kind of crucifix is going on here, and you sort of work out what the crucifix is, but then even then what happens is that another priest, the priest actually of the book, Hoyt his name is, I think, he actually then goes to Hyperion as well to try and find the priest that's gone before him. Yes, his name is Lenar Hoyt. And so then this other priest goes there, and he has his own horrific journey into Hyperion at the same time. Now, I really, really enjoyed this. Like, it's almost like a short, like, novella kind of short story in its own right there. Even if you just read it, you'd really enjoy it, even though it probably wouldn't make a whole lot of sense outside of the book. But that was really good. Now, the next story that we get to is, actually I made a note of this one, is The Soldier. Now this is a soldier who's actually very high up in the force kind of place, or he managed to get very high up, but he didn't start that way. He started off, I think he lived on in Mars or somewhere, but he went to Mars to train. He went on and he actually fought his way, well, didn't fight his way, but he managed to earn his way to the top of one of the force commands, one of the arms of the force, and he was very much involved in action with the ousters. And this is the story where we really get to know a lot about the ousters and of course the force side of things, and quite a bit more about the sort of like the setup of the hegemon there. And it's a very, very violent, there's quite a lot of sex in it as well, because the name of the soldier, Fedman Kassad, he actually meets someone, this mysterious woman, in a sort of virtual reality training facility kind of thing, and then keeps meeting her. And again, it's sort of weird, really weird, but of course there is another connection with a Shrike there, and again, I really enjoyed this story. It is very violent and a lot of sex, and sometimes at the same time, so the line between violence and sex is blurred, which is a bit weird, you know, when it suddenly happens and you're a bit caught out by that, but you're thinking, okay. So that's it's quite interesting. Now, as I'm reading this, you can see that it's all written in third person past tense, even though Kassad is telling the story himself in the frame story. He actually goes, and now this is my story, and starts talking it. Then it skips into third person, and we hear his story there a lot in that way. And yeah, there seems to be quite a lot of references to different literature as well in here as well. And the themes very much talks about brutality, the cost of war, fate in a way, because it's sort of like, who is this woman? Where is she going? You know, what's the connection here? It is very interesting. Of course, he does actually end up on Hyperion as well. Let's move on now, if I have not disconnected. Yes, because I've been disconnecting momentarily throughout this recording. Next up, we have the... Actually, I wrote this down. I don't need to look it in the book. Next up, we have the poet. Now, the poet is quite an interesting kind of story. Again, this goes into a weird sort of like... experiment, almost sort of like a structure experiment, because he starts and he says, now this is the place to start, and he starts telling stories, and then he goes, actually no, that's not a good place to start, now I'm going to go over here, I'm going to start my story there. So he starts talking about his story in a different way, but sort of like from a different angle with different themes, and then he goes, no, actually I'm going to talk about it in a different way, and then he actually starts his story in a more, you know, interesting place, or a more, well, I wouldn't say interesting, but a more accessible place for people to follow, which is actually when he was young. And this doesn't only follow the story of the poet himself, we also get to know a lot about Earth, and this is where we find out about Earth's history and sort of like the rise and the evacuation of Earth. And also, he goes to Hyperion too, but he doesn't have... Immediately, he doesn't have any connection with the Shrike or anything like that, but he's there as a poet because Hyperion is named after Keats, because there's this Mad King Charlie, Mad King Louis, Mad King Willie on Hyperion, and he goes there and he sets up his own kingdom, and it's a kingdom for poets. So that's why everything, well, not just poets, artists and sculptures and everything like that, and this king, this mad king with lots of investments and lots of money, he funds lots of poets and things like that. So Hyperion is named after a poem by Keats, and then there's the main city, which is called Keats, and then there's other places which are named after different poetic things, you know. Yes, which is lots and lots of references on Hyperion to poetry, and in fact, all the way through the book. Not only that, we've got the poet is talking a lot about what it's like to be an artist. He's going, oh, I'm a poet, and I'm talking about this, and he talks about selling out, and he talks about big successes and smaller successes, loads and loads of different stuff going on with the poet. It's probably the most sprawling of the stories, because you don't, you know, you go from Earth to the wider, you know, different all the different planets, you talk about different levels of society, and it's a good sort of middle of the book, because it brings you up to speed on the history, lots of different histories, but at the same time lots of literary references. It's all spoken, talks in first person past tense, but you know, it's very self-referential, lots and lots of kind of meta stuff going on there, and lots of postmodern kind of experiments going on there with the writing itself, and yet at the same time the poet is talking about being a writer and things. So, well, that's pretty cool. Next up, the next story is the story of... Again, I've got it written in front of me. I don't know why I keep going back to the book to check this out. The Scholar. And The Scholar is probably... This is probably one of my favourite... one of my favourite parts of the book, one of my favourite small stories within the overall book. It's The Scholar is this Jewish guy called... Weintraub? Sol... Let me look here. Number four. Sol Weintraub, and... Or Weintraub, maybe, I'm not sure. And it tells a story of his meeting his wife and then having a child and the child growing up and then the child getting a unique illness. I don't really want to give it away too much here, although it seems to be quite obvious if you've been following the book, because the scholar all the time has been carrying one of his children with him all the time. So you sort of understand what's going to happen, and as soon as you start talking, the daughter going to Hyperion, because the scholar hasn't been to Hyperion before, but the daughter has, and it tells this very, very sad story about then the father, like, slowly over time sort of losing connection with his daughter. And again, I don't really want to give it away, but it's really, really touching. It's like, because it's told as like a straight narrative, just as a short story, and you really get into the mind. This is one time where you really get into the mind of the scholar, and he has conversations with God, and again, it talks a lot about faith, not so much about religion, because the priest one was talking a lot more about religion and the like the kind of things that religion can do to you. This is with the priest and like the kind of the religious ceremonies and the iconography and all that kind of stuff. This is very much about more of a personal relationship with God, told in the, from the point of view of a Jewish scholar. And yeah, and it's just so touching, and it's like very personal. And I think of all the stories as well, it's most touching because it stands very much as a standalone story, or it could stand as a standalone story. Maybe, actually, all of these individual stories were written as standalone short stories and then put together into one book, but it doesn't read that way because they're so closely tied together, and they each make each other make a lot of sense in a way that, say, a book like... What was the book last year? Last time? Oh, Accelerando. Yeah, I actually looked it up online because I recorded that while I was on a cruise ship and I looked it up online. That was actually a collection of short stories just sort of thrown together into a novel. I never actually knew that when I recorded it, but it sort of makes a bit more sense as a book, but it doesn't make it any better. Whereas this book, Hyperion, all of the short stories could almost stand alone, but together they really work a lot better together than they would do apart. Okay, yes, so, yes, The Scholar, just getting straight back into it again, it's told as a straight narrative, like I say, as a short story, all put together. And, of course, it's like, I said before, maybe I got cut off a second ago, it's like the nicest story, but not just the nicest to read or the most enjoyable to read, because it's also it has no sex or violence in it. And even though it's got no sex and violence in it, it seems to be very much like the one of the more touching stories, but also one of the most horrific stories. Even though there's like violent, horrific things going on with the Shrike and with these other things going on at the same time, this action by the Shrike almost feels more inhumane than all of the other bloody, gory stuff which is going on in the other stories. I think that's probably all I wanted to say about that story there. Next story is Detective. Now, this is the only main female character, or the only female character who is on the pilgrimage going along the way here. And she is, of course, a private investigator, which gives Dan Simmons here an excuse to play around with sort of like the hard-boiled kind of noir detective styling. So it's first person, past tense, lots of action, lots of guns, lots of sex, lots of it's sort of very much the cyberpunk kind of section of the book as well. So we talk about virtual reality space, and I think at one point it's not just virtual reality space, I think they call it Gibsonian space, and which is you know, another nod to I guess the cyberpunk, which is just coming onto the scene back there in about 1989, or is it 1986? Was the William Gibson kind of stuff, neuromancer going on? I don't know, but anyway, it's very much that is what it is what we have here. So it's actually quite fun to begin with, because I was like, woohoo, now we've done sort of the touching story, close personal story with the this kind of stuff. We've got the poet's big sprawling story with lots of different literary references, and we've got all these other kind of stuff going on. And now we have like the hard boiled, like I say, detective story going on there. The thing is, it was, like I say, fun, but not as satisfying as the other stories. I think this is probably one of the least satisfying of all the stories, except actually is least satisfying so far, except for the last one, which is the console story. But again, we learn a lot more about this is where we really get into the nitty gritty of the politics behind the techno core and the politics behind the hegemony. Can't say the word again. The hegemony, and because the character here, which I'll just look up, the character is no, can't find the name. Lamia. Oh yes, that's it. Lamia Brown. And again, Brown is the name of Keats' lover in real life, which I've forgotten about, of course, until we actually read. In that story, one of the people, you know, that she meets along the way is sort of like really into Keats. I'm not going to spoil it, but yeah, there's lots of Keats references, and he actually mentions Fanny, his lost love, and I thought Fanny was Brown, and then I was like, oh yeah, and this main character in this section is also called Brown. Yeah, it's one of these things, and again, this is so full of different literary references, but not just like the noir cyberpunk kind of references, but a lot more of the poetry is in this one as well. Unlike the religious and different bits and pieces. Yeah, this is another poetry reference heavy chapter or story as we go along here. So that's a pretty cool bit of a story. And then, of course, we get to the console. Now, the console is actually our main protagonist in a way, because when we're following, like, the prologue, we follow the console, and then all the sections in between, all the, like, beginnings of ends of chapters in between the stories within the frame story, The overall story on the outside is being told from the point of view of the consul, and we never actually know his name. I don't think we ever get to know his name, but he's just the consul, and all the time he's sort of like a bit mysterious, and we're following their journey across Hyperion. We're getting to know Hyperion through their story, and they sort of maybe have run-ins with the Shrike, not really quite sure what's going on. They see battles in space, not quite sure what's going on there either, and so... It starts off with the console. He gets out a tape recorder and he presses play. So we've got like another frame story within another frame story, which is quite interesting. And this tape tells the story of pretty much two star-crossed lovers, as Shakespeare would say in Romeo and Juliet. And we do have lots and lots of Shakespearean kind of references going on here. And I say the star-crossed lovers, not just because we've got this weird kind of two lovers from different places and a sword fight right near the beginning and all these different kind of things that you get from Romeo and Juliet, but there's a lot of other stuff going on there as well. And star-crossed lovers is because what's actually happened is that you've got this young guy who's on a starship going backwards and forwards, and they're trying to install a Tharcaster on a different planet, on this sort of like ocean planet. And when he gets there the first time, he has an affair with a girl, and then he keeps going back there on all the different runs that he does. But for him, it's only a few months apart, but for the girl, it's like 7-8 years apart each time. And so she's growing up really fast and he's growing up really slowly, but you know, there's this whole kind of weird legend that grows up around them, and it continues through. And this story shows another side of the overall civilization and the way that they annex different planets which are not part of the overriding kind of civilization so far. So we get a lot more politics in this one, and it's also, strangely enough, it's got this non-linear narrative, first person present tense, which it really at this point seemed, instead of me enjoying this one, it really seemed, it's like, hey, Dan Simmons, he's done first person past tense, he's done third person past tense, he's done this, and now he's going present tense, first person, non-linear. And it really felt forced at that point. It's like he's run out of other things to do, so he's going to try this instead. And for me, it really didn't work, because it's like, okay, the console gets out a tape recorder, presses play, but then did he press skip back, skip back, skip back, skip back track, and then fast forward, skip back, skip back? No, he wouldn't. He would have just played it in the same order that it would have been recorded in, wouldn't it? I'm not sure. But maybe the person who recorded it out of line and all non-linear. So that was a bit weird kind of thing going on there. And there didn't really seem to be much point in the non-linearity of this section, except that, again, Dan Simmons wanted to play around with it. But it didn't, you know, it's sort of like it seemed a bit cheap and a bit too much of showing off. And then, of course, when the tapes finish, everyone goes, oh, that was a moving story. And then the consul tells his own story. Now, this is what really, really annoyed me about this book. Up until this point in the book, I thought it was absolutely fantastic. The thing is, the consul is too powerful. He knows too much. He's like one of the only people in the entire galaxy who has his own personal starship. He's like the top guy. He's been the top guy in Hyperion. And he's been a top guy galaxy-wide and stuff like that. And he, of course, because he's like this top diplomat, he's going to know stuff that nobody else knows, and he does know that, and then he just tells all the other people. So really, sort of the whole motivation at the beginning of the book is like, hey, let's all tell each other stories at the, you know, tell each other's stories, and we'll pool our knowledge and see what we can do, and we can see who knows what. Yeah, which is a bit strange, because then at the end the consul knows everything and he just tells everything. It's like, oh, remember when you said that? That's what actually happened. And remember when you said that? I don't really want to spoil actually what he says, but it's very, very disappointing that you get all the way through to the end of the book and we're only like, what, 15 pages away from the end? And suddenly he wraps up all the loose ends. It's like, oh, and this person was working for this person and this person's working for this person. Which is all disappointing at that point. Whereas the overall story, like the actual, if you just read it as an individual short story, it would have actually been a bit more interesting than just being used to sort of really clumsily tie up all the loose ends at the end of the novel here. But then that's not the end of the novel. The end of the novel is tells us what happens, because everyone at this point has told their stories. Actually, there's a seventh character, but they don't make it through to tell their story. Hopefully, by the time you read the book, you'd have forgotten that I told you that, because it is a little bit of a spoiler, but don't worry too much about it. So we've got all these different sections, and then it finishes, and then what happens? They finish their pilgrimage. Oh, they're almost at the end of the pilgrimage, and then they all go and meet the Shrike, except that's where the book finishes and it just stops and that's it. So it's got this weird thing where in one way the book ties up too many loose ends, and in the other way the book leaves you hanging on this really annoying cliffhanger. And I think what it could have done is, instead of just, there's a real contrast there between the end of the console story, where you actually find out about all the different stuff going on, and all these other mysteries of people going, "Oh, I'm not really sure what's going on here. Oh, I don't know what's going on." And then the console goes, "Actually, this is all what's happening." And you're like, "Okay." And then at the very end, it just cuts off. It cuts off really, really quite short. But the thing is, I did know that this was the first book in a series, even though, what does it say in the beginning? Nothing about it being the first in the series. And on the back, no, nothing about it being the first in the series. And on the inside cover, nothing. Well, actually, it does say it's first in the series. It says Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion. So I guess the story picks up in the Fall of Hyperion. Although, from what I've heard when people recommending this book is say, don't, the second book isn't quite so good. But I'm definitely going to read it because this really did leave me wanting more. So that's all I want to talk about of the story. I guess overall story, like I say, I need to read the next book to find out if I actually like the story itself. But I hope that the characters that we found out about in this book, I hope they're the main characters in the next book, because it would have been a real waste if we just used these six short stories that we have here. And yeah, sorry, I got distracted there by the video. So it would be a real pity if we just know the story of Hyperion and the background to the world from this book, and then we follow new characters, because I really want to stick with these characters. Moving on, next section, past the story. I guess references, I just want to talk a bit about this. Are the references in this book, there's so many of them. You know, there's like, I noticed dozens and dozens and dozens of literary references and cultural references and poetry references and stuff. Not so much of the poetry, because I'm not a big poetry reader. Although, just by osmosis, I sort of picked up enough in my past reading and different things to be able to pick up then on the references that we have here in Hyperion. But sometimes I just think it goes a little bit too far. Like he goes Gibsonian space. It's all like, oh, that's a nice shout out to Gibson. And then he goes Hawking drive and Hawking mat and Hawking radiation and Hawking this and Hawking that. And it's like, wow, you really like, you know, Hawking's, don't you? And all his different technology. It's sort of like, yeah, okay, we know that you're a fan of Hawking, so you don't need to put that in. And then the whole Keats thing, it's like the entire future of the world here, of Hyperion, not just the planet Hyperion, it's like the entire world seems to be set up as some kind of reflection of Keats. Now, I don't know Keats's poetry enough, and sure, this Hyperion book might be, in the same way that it's being a bit of a retelling of, or in the same kind of structure as the Canterbury Tales, maybe it's also retelling something like Hyperion, the poetry of Hyperion, or the poem Hyperion, and the other Hyperion kind of stuff, and the other poems that I mentioned here in the book. But I'm just not good enough, I just don't know that enough, so it really felt like it was a bit too clever, like sort of like I mentioned before about the Braun reference, and then the Romeo and Juliet reference, and then even the name of the main guy, this main guy on the front of the book here, the Shrike. It's like, as soon as I read that, I was like, oh, okay, so the Shrike, I know that's a bird, but I never really didn't really click with me. And then you find out the actual Shrike in the book impales the people that he's killed. He impales them on a tree, and I was like, oh, that's where I know it from. The Shrike is the bird which he kills insects and other birds and lizards and stuff, and then sticks them on spikes and thorns and stuff to keep for later. And I was like, oh, well, that was really, I mean, it's really, I don't know, is the name calling it a shrike after a bird which sticks things on spikes? Of course, that's where it's come from in names, but then it's never actually said. None of the characters say, oh, we named the shrike after the shrike because of the bird, because he sticks things on trees. That's never said. So I'm like, is it meant to be a clever reference, or is it meant to be a reference that everyone's meant to pick up on? And all of the references that I was getting through the book, and of course all the references that I didn't pick up on, I was always like, this kind of thing, is Dan Simmons, is he just playing with this, or is he actually serious? And I was never really quite sure if what I was meant to read into all of the references here. And some of them were just a bit clumsy, like at the end, they all link arms and start singing, "We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz." And I'm just like, seriously? Like, really, do you need to say that? And it's, yeah, it's a bit strange. That kind of really blatant, clunky reference that they throw in. But the more subtle reference I enjoyed, but then, like, the Shrike. Okay. Anyway, moving on to characters. Characters, all of them, of course, very well-rounded, because they've all got, like, a whole short story, and you spend a whole chapter each in their boots and find out about their past and their story. More some than others, but you, of course, all of their motivations really well-rounded, or some of them. Actually, the motivations of why they're going on the pilgrimage with the Shrike is well set out. But the actual motivation of them all telling their stories and what they're actually doing as they go along seems really, really weak. It's sort of like the characters are... they're stronger than the actual story that ties them together, which is a bit of pity. There's minor characters. Some of them do seem a bit simple, because all of them seem to have like a love interest. Well, not all of them, but there is this weird kind of like, this person is going to be the love interest, and they just sort of fill that slot. And as long as it sort of fills the slot okay. I don't know, it's a bit of a weird kind of thing going on there, that it seemed to be a bit too simple for each of them to fall in love. Because that's what all of them seem to do. It's sort of like, aha, and now this is it. Great. And they just get the girl. But maybe, of course, those are the people who are good enough to actually take part in the book. Anyone who can't get the girl isn't interesting enough to go on a pilgrimage to Hyperion. Next up, yes, lots of battles, lots of different stuff. Oh, technology, yeah. Again, like I said before, I went into some of the technology before. You know, all stuff that I've pretty much seen before, and some of it is just a little bit too fantasy-like. Each of the individual ideas is really good fun, but the way that they sort of sit together in the whole world building, the whole universe kind of thing, it's sort of like, we need starships. Here's a starship, and this one's a tree. And you're like, okay. And then you go, and this is a Farcaster, and this is the way that Farcasters work, because that's the way they have to work. And you're like, okay. Oh, and this is this other kind of technology, and that's that. And you're like, okay. Oh, and there's this as well. And you're like, okay. But none of them seem to hang together really well. It's sort of like, okay, if you do have massive artificial intelligence, maybe they would have helped out and done this other stuff. Maybe. Don't really know. And if you've got this Farcaster, why are you still doing this? Don't really know. And, you know, there's lots of weird kind of things that like the technology doesn't hang together. Like, you go, and this works with this, and you've got this magic flying carpet, and you're like, that's really cool, a flying carpet. And then you go, it doesn't really work everywhere, you know, can't have people flying here, so we're going to have a magnet. I don't know, maybe I'm just waffling a bit here. I'm always being distracted by the video thing going on here. But the themes of the book, lots and lots of different themes, way too many to go into here. And of course, I talked a little bit about them as I went through, you know, like I said, the priest, lots of religious kind of themes going on. The last one I want to mention, it seems to be a little bit of an anti-globalism kind of thing going on there, because the consul is, I don't know, but in his story, it seems to lift up the people, the isolationists on the different planets there seem to be like held up as the big heroes, partly. And then in other things, it seems to be, you know, the whole kind of globalism thing not really good there. And there's a good great I really enjoy the whole Shrike as a religious figure, that he has his own religion going on, but it's not just his religion that look up to him as a religious figure, but because he's sort of like outside of the control of technology, he's sort of like this thing that you require faith to counter, or you know, sort of outside of it, you know, the artificial intelligences are afraid of the Shrike. It's that kind of thing where the gods are afraid of this thing. So it's sort of like a god among gods, and I quite like that kind of idea that goes on there as well. Again, you don't really get that all the way through, and it's just sort of hovering there in the background. But really, what I think I need to do is again read the second book of Hyperion, because once I've read the second book, then I'll be able to see where the themes of this book play out in the next book. So, my conclusion, this was a really, really good, fun book to read. As someone who actually likes literary books, well, not so much just literary books, but I like reading books about writing, and that's what this book really is, because you're really playing with the form, you're playing with the frame structure, like the frame story. Each individual story has got like a different thing, you know, and I like writing as well, so I'm thinking, hey, what should I do with the writing style? You know, is it going to be third person, first person, present tense, past tense, all these different kind of things? And Dan Simmons, he talks about them all, and he demonstrates them all into actually quite an interesting kind of way, with all the different structures as well, like the different non-linear kind of stuff going on there, and parallel stories and large casts, and then each individual things have got small casts. It's like a book of books. It's like a book which talks, which is a discussion on writing in its own right, which is, again, I think is the main theme of the book. You could probably use this book to like, if an English teacher read the book, they'd love it. Or they'd probably give it to their students and say, hey, read this. This will teach you all of the different tricks that you can use. But yet, that's more of like just a surface reading as I was reading it. And then when I was getting to the end, and like I really enjoyed it up until the last thing, and then the last two short stories that was there sort of trailed off a bit, and then at the end it was a bit disappointing. So I actually enjoyed the reading of the book more than the actual me, once I finished the book, closed the last page and then looked back at it. I sort of had it felt like the author, Dan Simmons, had been sort of playing a trick on me and sort of like, hey, this will be what you're like. It's like porn, but not like like pornography, even though it does have a lot of sex in it, but it's sort of like writing porn. It's like science fiction porn. It's sort of like everything is really blatantly, and when you're sort of reading it, like watching porn, because I don't read a lot of watch a lot of it, but sort of like as it's going, it's like, yeah. And then once you finish it, you like feel dirty because it's been so blatantly like someone's thrown a bucket of something over you, again not literally, whereas like mostly if you like use your own imagination with porn and you don't just watch it there on screen, you can you know, it sort of like drips in. And again, maybe I'm taking this analogy way too far, but I'm just saying this is literally when I finished the book, as I'm going through it felt good, but then at the end of the book it felt someone had just thrown a big bucket of water over me. Yeah, people in the chat room are going blimey, which is, I'm thinking that as well. Maybe I'm going red talking about me watching porn, which I don't actually do, to be honest. People go, yeah, of course, but I don't actually do it. Read it, yeah, of course. Watch it, not really. Anyway, so I've lost myself. Let me get back to my notes here. Yes, sections of the book I really liked. The overall kind of thing I liked. I liked the mystery of the book. I really didn't like the way that the mystery was all tied up again at the end. And yeah, the reading of it was more enjoyable than the actual final closing of the book and going, how did I actually enjoy that? Which is a bit weird. So overall, like as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, five-star book, definitely going to be a five-star book. Of course, when I got to the end, I was thinking, three-and-a-half-star book. But actually, I think maybe four-star book. I'd give it more than 4 stars because I really did enjoy reading this book. But again, it's that kind of thing. It's the first, definitely very, very much a first in a series. So I definitely need to read the second book to sort of the Fall of Hyperion. And once I read that, then I'll be able to say if I actually did like this, because it seems to be very much just half a book. It's not a full book itself. So I'm going to give this 4 stars pending my review of Fall of Hyperion, which I'm definitely going to read as soon as possible. I'm going to go probably to the bookshop tomorrow and see if I can pick it up and read it in a few books' time and do a review of that. So yeah, 4-star book. So I hope you've enjoyed that review. Certainly interesting going into a lot of detail about the book. Hopefully didn't spoil too much, even though I sort of did go into detail of all the different sections all the way through into the end. Hopefully you didn't mind about my pornography analogy there at the end. That's it. 4 stars. The next book that I'm going to be reviewing is by a brother team. Like, it's actually written by two people, Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, and it's called The Final Circle of Paradise. Now, this was actually written back in 1976 in Russia, so we're talking behind the Iron Curtain Cold War science fiction. I've got about a chapter and a half into it so far. It's certainly quite interesting so far, and yeah, hopefully I'll be able to finish that up by the end of the weekend and then stick another review out next week. Okay, that was the recording that I did earlier on this evening, and yeah, so that was pretty cool. Hopefully you enjoyed it. So get back in touch if you enjoyed it, this podcast, or if you've got anything to say about my Hyperion view. It's luke@juggler.net. That is my email address, or you can, I guess you can Twitter me. I'm not really quite sure about that technology or anything like that, or leave stuff on the sfbrp.com wiki, which lots of people have done. Someone just left a whole ream of book suggestions on there, which is pretty cool. Yeah, any book suggestions that you've got, email me them as well. And again, keep in touch by the lukebudge.com/blog if you want to find out about other projects and reading and writing. Following this podcast will be another one where I answer questions from the chat room live. I'll edit that into a separate podcast and put it up there on the feed as well. So catch you next time.